The Rockies are undefeated to start the 2023 season, but is the style in which they beat the Padres on opening day going to be sustainable throughout the year? This is Adjusting for Altitude.
Baseball is a difficult game. The average hitter gets on base in less than 40% of their plate appearances, yet the average pitcher gives up 4 runs every 9 innings pitched. The sport is a challenge on its own. But in Altitude, the problems for baseball players compound. Less break on pitches, balls that fly significantly farther than at sea level, and then after playing in such a treacherous environment, the players play in normality for half of their regular season. Adjustments must be made by those who don the purple pinstripes of the Colorado Rockies. We discuss those adjustments here. This is Adjusting for Altitude with baseball fanatic and aspiring MLB general manager, Christopher Nelson II.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, you already know what this is. Welcome to episode 3 of Adjusting for Altitude with me, Christopher Nelson II. Today's episode is sponsored by an undefeated Colorado Rockies team. How about that? A whole 1-0 tied with the Los Angeles Dodgers atop the National League West. One of about 15 major league teams who are undefeated after the first day of the regular season, if my math is correct. And I do believe my math is correct. The Rockies hold this prestigious honor. We'll see how long they can hold this prestigious honor. My guess is that it won't be for much longer, but you never know. You never know. Guys can start to get momentum after they start playing well. If they start seeing the ball leave their bat with some velocity, you know, pitchers start to see some strikeouts come their way. You never know where a season can take you. But if you want to hear my preview for each member of the Colorado Rockies this upcoming season, you should have already listened to last week's episode. If you are new to this podcast, that's about your only excuse. If you aren't, then I don't know what you're doing. Go take a listen to episode 2 because episode 2 is really good. A few of my projections, I guess, because both words are valid in this scenario. Either way, a few of my predictions are already incorrect, mostly with the lineup. Then again, the Rockies don't have a fully healthy lineup, and I may or may not have underestimated certain Rockies in this lineup. But we'll get to all that in just a second, but I feel like you guys might want to know a little bit more behind the voice of this podcast. If indeed you do, you are more than welcome to go follow me over on Instagram at I Am The Second. That's IAMTHASECOND. If you want the high quality content that I post on my Instagram account, some of it baseball related, some of it not. It's good stuff though. You should go and follow that Instagram if you do not at this moment in time. But with that said, ladies and gentlemen, I cannot believe it. Opening day is finally here. It has come and it is gone. We've now got to wait a whole extra 365, maybe 366 days, because I guess next year is a leap year with it being 2024. Nonetheless, we've got to wait a while for opening day to come again, but we are all very thankful that opening day has come and gone because that means the MLB season is fully underway. But we still had some spring training business to wrap up over the last week, as well as opening day. This is going to be this week's edition of The Week in Review.
This is Adjusting for Altitude's Week in Review.
Alrighty. So let's go take a look at how the Rockies ended spring training. Last Saturday, the Rockies took on the Cleveland Guardians. Shane Bieber took the win in this game for Cleveland, as Cleveland won 4-2 over the Rocks. Carl Kauffman took the loss for the Rockies in this game. Went 4 innings, gave up 4 hits, 2 runs, both earned, only recorded 1 strikeout. He ended up being optioned to AAA shortly after this game or a few days later. Bullpen looked solid. In relief of him, though, Brent Suter came in, gave up 2 hits in 1 inning, gave up 1 run, but maintained a 2.57 ERA for the spring, so no complaining really to be had there. Justin Lawrence came in through 1 inning, 1 walk, but K'd the side, maintaining a very solid spring for him as well. Brad Hand came in and cleaned up the mess of a spring that he's had thus far with a solid inning of work with 1K. Same with Dennelson Lamet, one inning, 1K. And Daniel Bard, who we will discuss in a little bit more detail a little bit later in this episode, came in and threw a solid inning, gave up a run, but you know, got a strikeout. It was a solo shot, like we usually like to say. Solo shots will not do very much damage, unless, of course, they are walk-offs. Rocks took the loss in this game. Nothing really noteworthy on the offensive end. On Sunday, the Rockies had split squad action. Half the squad took on the White Sox. Half the squad took on the Cincinnati Reds. Rockies beat the Chicago White Sox in that split squad game 4-2. I think the pitching in this game was pretty solid. Austin Gomber, how about this? 5 innings, 1 hit allowed, 1 walk, 3 Ks, maintaining a very solid spring for him with a 3.78. Ty Block came in, pitched 2 innings, solid baseball, 2 hits allowed in those 2 innings. Gavin Hollowell came in and had a minor hiccup, his first hiccup of the spring, gave up 2 runs, both earned in 1 inning pitched, in addition to 3 hits. He did get a strikeout that inning, though, to, I guess, account for a little bit of, well, improvement for that inning that he pitched. Matt Koch came in and got an inning of work in with 1K as well. But overall, solid win for the boys in that game. Nolan Jones went 2-for-3. Michael Tolia went 2-for-5. And they were the offensive highlights from that split squad. Dang, if I could say that word, it'd be absolutely amazing. Split squad game with the White Sox. The other split squad game was unfortunately an L for the Rockies. They lost 7-5 to the Cincinnati Reds. Taking the loss, well, I guess I probably should cover that in the last game too. Gomber obviously got the win against the White Sox. Lucas Giolito took the L for the White Sox in that game. Got to Giolito early in that game. Big shout out to the Rocks young guys for that. But in the Cincinnati Reds-Rockies game, the one that we lost 7-5, Derek Law took the win for the Cincinnati Reds. Kyle Freeland picked up the L. Kyle ended up pitching only 3 1/3 innings in this game, giving up 8 hits, 4 runs. Only 3 of them were earned, though, and got 1 strikeout. It might look bad on the surface, considering he only threw those 3 innings and gave up a decent amount of runs in that time, but I did get to watch a little bit of that one. That one was on TV. Kyle looked like he was messing around with a whole variety of breaking balls and such, so I don't think that should be too much of a cause for concern. Other than that, the bullpen came in and did its job. Austin Kitchen pitched the remainder of that inning that Kyle could not finish, got a strikeout, shut the inning down. Jake Bird pitched 2 innings, got a K, no runs allowed. Fernando Abad, something similar, 1 inning, 2 strikeouts. Nick Mears came in, gave up 3 runs. That's not good. Not good for Nick, and I do believe he was actually assigned to AAA earlier in that week as well. So he's got some stuff to work through. With the walks and the command of the fastball and such. Pierce Johnson came in, though, and restored order, pitching an inning, giving up only 1 hit, but striking out 2. The offensive highlights from this game, again, were kind of few and far between. Even though there were 5 runs scored, Brenton Doyle did go 2-for-3 in this game, so shout out Brenton Doyle. He will also start the year at AAA, just a reminder. Another prospect to keep an eye on, though, for the Rockies this year. On Monday, the Rockies played the Milwaukee Brewers and took a 12-8 W in that game. Jose Urania picked up the dub. Eric Lauer took the loss for the Brew Crew. Urania in this game went a solid, maybe not so solid, 3 innings. Gave up 3 runs, 2 hits, 4 walks. That's going to be a problem if that trend continues. Hopefully it doesn't for Jose. He got 3 strikeouts, though. Did give up a home run as part of those 3 runs earned. Connor Siebold came in, and despite opening the year on the roster, I should say, earning an opening day spot, did not pitch well the subsequent game. Gave up 3 runs here in 1.1 innings pitched. Did strike out 4, though, so fairly solid. Brent Suter came in, gave up a run on 2 hits in 2/3 of an innings pitched. Dennelson Lamet came in, pitched a clean inning. Same with Brad Hand. Did walk 1 batter, though, even though he got a strikeout. Not too bad. So Brad is trending in a better direction than earlier spring outings would have suggested. Daniel Bard came in, gave up a run in 0.2 innings pitched. So he also walked 2, did get 2 strikeouts, though. But again, we'll have to get to Daniel a little bit later on in this episode. And then a few other minor leaguers came in. I don't know who Darnell is. I know who Poulin is, though. I think he's a guy who's going to start the year at AA or AAA, one of the two. I've heard he's a reliever to look out for in the Rockies organization. Other than that, 12-8 win, can't complain. Pitching wasn't amazing, but the offense carried the day. Then in the final game of spring training, the Rockies got absolutely destroyed by the Brewers. 8-1, Freddie Peralta picked up the win in his final spring tune-up for the Brew Crew over Ryan Feltner, who took the L for the Colorado Rockies. Ryan went 4.1 innings pitched, gave up 6 hits, 4 runs, all of which were earned, walked 4 while striking out 4, but he also gave up 2 home runs in the process. Ryan did earn a spot on the roster as the Rockies' 5th starter in the rotation to open the year. But again, you just got to get the walks in order, man. He likes to pull himself a little bit too much on his fastball, and that makes his fastball command a little bit erratic at times, and that just isn't good for the rest of his arsenal when people don't respect the fastball. It's hard to respect much else. But other than that, the offensive highlights from this game were obviously very few and far between. Ryan McMahon did go 1-for-2 in this game, as did Mr. Brenton Doyle and CJ Krohn as well. Michael Tolia, I believe I just saw. Yeah, Tolia went 2-for-2 in this game too as well. So solid outing for a few of these guys, most of which will be expected to be contributors throughout the year. But that was how the Colorado Rockies ended their spring training. They ended spring with a record of 13-19. But what we're all here for is opening day. Yes, indeed. Even though the game was delayed from its original 2:10 Mountain Time start time to 7:40 p.m., the Rockies did not care as they picked up the opening day win against the heavily favored to win the World Series this year, San Diego Padres. Oh, I shouldn't say heavily favored, but many people do suspect that they will be the ones to unseat the Dodgers, not only this year, but potentially 4 years to come. Many do have them actually winning the World Series this year as well. So the Rockies knocked them off. That's pretty impressive, especially considering it's on the road in a ballpark that they usually struggle to score runs at over the last few years. Herman Marquez picked up the opening day win over Blake Snell. Herman looked absolutely fantastic. 6 innings pitched, 5 hits allowed, 2 runs, both earned, 5 strikeouts. Can't complain about that. Solid outing from Marquez. And then the bullpen came in and did its job. Denelson Lamet, 1 inning, worked himself out of a problem that he worked himself into, giving up 2 hits, starting off the inning with 2 runners on, nobody out, but he ended up getting back-to-back strikeouts and ending that inning where it was. Justin Lawrence came in, pitched a very, very clean 8th inning. 3 strikeouts, K'd the side in the 8th, and then Jake Bird at that point came in to lock it down in the 9th. And I know some of you guys are thinking, if you aren't aware already, Jake Bird, did he not get assigned to AAA to start the year? Yes, he did, until he was called back up because of Daniel Bard. Man, I'm really building up this Daniel Bard thing, aren't I? It's really not a very huge thing, but it's going to impact the Rockies to some extent. Obviously, when you don't have your closer on your roster, that does impact the things that you're able to do and your strategy and strategizing for future games. But the offense in this game was spectacular. 17 hits. Even though they struck out 17 times, don't matter. We can ignore that. Chris Bryant, 3-for-5. Solid game for him in RBI. CJ Krohn, though, carried the evening. 4-for-5. 5 RBIs, including 2 home runs. Eloris Montero also ended the game with a 2-for-5 stat line and a home run of his own. And with that, the Colorado Rockies knocked off the San Diego Padres on opening day. Well, that was the week in review, but as always, it's time to dive into some things a little bit further, because there are some things that do need to be dived into a little bit further, as there are going to be on most weeks. So with that said, let's just hop right into this week's deeper dive.
It's time for a deeper dive.
So just a few general notes from the week that I picked up. First one is not necessarily just pertinent to the Rockies, just pertinent to baseball in general. I get that we've had a lot of rule changes so far this year. That said, there is really no excuse for what I saw yesterday. I went through, and throughout the course of the day, I believe I watched about 3 or 4 games live, chunks of 3 or 4 games during the day. I know I watched Cardinals Blue Jays for a little bit. I know I watched a little bit of Astros White Sox, and a little bit of Rangers Phillies, in addition to obviously the Rockies Padres game in the evening. And then I went back and watched highlights of other games from opening day as well. And something I noticed that was just completely surprising, completely took me by surprise. The umpiring was absolutely atrocious yesterday. It was really bad. I don't know why this would be. I don't think that the television broadcast crews who set up the little strike zone box for the broadcast to allow the fans watching at home the ability to see what pitches are balls and strikes in an easier manner have altered their strike zone box in any significant manner. Whatever the case may be, yesterday's officiating has to be all around the worst I've ever seen. Officiating, umpiring, same thing, effectively. It was just not good. Pitches way above the zone were being called strikes. Pitches low. That's what I noticed the most. Actually, of all the pitches that were missed, it seemed like pitches just off the plate in either direction were being called strikes. And that was very weird. Very weird. They weren't even really close. They were about an inch or two off the plate, low and off the plate, and they were being called strikes. And I was honestly, for all teams involved, not just the Rockies, because everybody suffered from this umpire's, I don't even know what to call it, but everybody suffered in some regard. So I'm not even being biased here. It was just bad. So that's just a note I had, generally speaking, about opening day. I don't know why that was. It was just weird. It was just a weird thing that I picked up on. But overall, it was good to see. I'd say it was a fairly successful implementation or first game implementation in games that count of the pitch clock. I think the pitch clock only had a few violators on opening day, nothing super significant, but there were definitely moments. There were moments that could have potentially been impactful, none of which were really on the rule itself, though, more so on the players. So I know, that's another game I watched. Sorry, I was talking about Phillies and Rangers. I didn't really watch much of that one. It was Orioles Red Sox. I watched a decent amount of that game. That was the MLB TV free game of the day. Rafi Devers was up in, I believe it was the eighth inning, and he just, the pitch before, roped a foul ball home run down the left field line, bringing his count to 1-2, and he got called for a pitch clock violation, striking out. Now, at that point in time, the Boston Red Sox were down to the Baltimore Orioles like 10-4. So this did not look like a game. It did not look like the Red Sox had a chance to come back and compete in this game. The Boston Red Sox ended up losing 10-9. And at that point in time, one only reasonably has to ask themselves, pitch clock? Is the pitch clock to blame for maybe the Red Sox losing a run here? And I'm just going to tell you straight up, no. No, it's not. I mean, even Alex Cora said after the game when he was asked about it, and he was like, so Rafi Devers struck out on a pitch clock violation. Cora didn't blame the rule. He blamed Rafi. He's like, he just simply has to be ready. At 8 seconds, he has to be engaged with the pitcher. That's not the rule's fault. That's Rafi's fault. So it seems like we understand that these rules are not only here to stay, but that they're actually beneficial for the game, which I'd agree with. The other notable pitch clock violation that occurred on opening day was in the Indians-Mariners game, the Guardians, I guess they're now called, right, with the rebranding. The Guardians-Mariners game, it was like the eighth inning. It was a close game. I believe it was actually 0-0. And James Karinchak gets put in for the Guardians, reliever. Actually, I believe he was a former All-Star like a few years ago. Pretty good curveball. Anywho, Karinchak gets put in. He's usually known as a pretty good reliever. This man, when I tell you this man was rattled by the pressure of the pitch clock on the road in a tied game, I mean, he was rattled. He was rattled. He got called for one. I don't remember if it resulted in a walk or whatever it was, but he has a more deliberate motion, and as such, he takes a little bit more time to wind himself up, and he's more used to deliberately getting into his pitches. Well, no longer will deliberate pitchers be tolerated. And he did get called for a pitch clock violation in that eighth inning. And you could just see he was rattled. The next pitch, I believe he threw to the backstop after being called for the pitch clock violation. And he ended up giving up a 3-run home run later that inning to tie France to surrender the lead to the Mariners late in that ballgame, a ballgame they'd end up losing. But nonetheless, I think the pitch clock was implemented well, despite the bad umpiring. But now on to the game that we all care about, which is Rockies-Padres. Now, it's only natural for me as a Rockies fan to look at a 7-2 win, a game in which we racked up 17 hits. By the way, the first game of the year, obviously, it's opening day. The Rockies did not record a single game last year where they had more than 14 hits on the road. There was not a single road game the Rockies played last year where they got more than 14 hits in a game. They did it game number one against a team that many people expect to be a World Series team this year. So excuse me if I have a little bit of optimism this year. I know it's very easy to get optimistic after because we usually win the first game of the year, most years, at least recently it seems like. And there's all this optimism and such. So excuse my optimism, but I do think that there's some encouraging signs to be had from this game. And I'm going to start off with the first note that I had, which is the surprise moments. The big moments that seemingly happened at not so big times. So the Rockies in this game were down 2-1 in, I believe, the fifth inning. And they had second and third with one out. Now, they'd already had second and third twice in this game, I believe, with one out. And they had one run to show for it. Runners left on base, not a good thing. Not usually a strategy for winning. And the Rockies left, let me tell you, they left runners on base in this game. 27 of them combined in 9 innings. It's just something the Rockies have been good at doing over the last few years. However, a man named CJ Krohn stepped up to the box in the fifth inning with runners on second and third and one out against newly entered reliever Nabil Chrismat. See, to this point in the game, CJ already had an RBI single, but the RBI single kind of got overshadowed, obviously, when we lost the lead. What didn't get overshadowed to me, prior to what I'm about to discuss, was the fact that CJ struck out on a very weak-looking swing. I think it was like the third inning. And then later, to give up the lead to the Padres, he made a terrible throw on what could have very well been an inning-ending double play, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, an inning-ending double play. He threw the ball wide to Tovar at second, allowing the runner to score and no out to be recorded. Now, at this point in time, I'm thinking, wow, CJ, what are you doing, bud? What are you doing? I don't know what I'm watching on my television screen. And then against Nabil Chrismat, second and third, the Rockies having already stranded second and third two times prior to the fifth inning, CJ Krohn decides to hit a 348-foot game-leading three-run home run. Yes, 348 feet, in case you didn't hear it on the broadcast last night. That does not leave any other stadium except for Petco Park. It literally does not. But CJ managed to hit it. And all that matters is that CJ did hit it, because after that point in time, the Rockies never surrendered the lead again. But that doesn't really get to the point that I was mentioning earlier, or just a few seconds ago, rather. The surprise moments, the big moments at seemingly not big times. That was a pretty big time to have it, but it was a 1-2 count. It was a 1-2 count. And at that point in time, I'm not going to lie, I was honestly thinking, uh-oh, here we go again. We're going to put ourselves in a two-out, runners in scoring position situation that we're likely not going to capitalize on. Nope. Nope. CJ said, that ends here. That ends with me. But again, that's not really a super surprise moment. What was a surprise moment was when they being the Padres, later in this game, in the seventh inning of this game, it's still 4-2 Rockies. I believe, no, it's 5-2 Rockies at this point in time, because they did get a run in the sixth. They put Domingo Tapia in. Padres put Domingo Tapia in to this ball game. And CJ Krohn promptly greets him with a solo home run. We're thinking, oh, okay, nice. 6-2. Great. Expand the lead. Then Elleris Montero greets Domingo Tapia with a solo home run. And at that point, it was 7-2. And the Rockies effectively had this game in the bag, to me at least. Because one of the things I've been touting before I started this podcast is the fact that this is a very, very new look bullpen. And it's a bullpen that has a lot of guys who have seemingly improved over the last or from last season. So there's a lot of optimism. As soon as I saw 7-2, I was like, okay, we might not have Bard. Again, I'm building it up. I keep building it up. It's really not that exciting. And most of you have probably already heard of it by the time you're listening to this podcast, but it doesn't matter. So even without Bard, I was like, we still got Pierce Johnson. You could run Lawrence out there in the eighth inning, maybe. And I think we'll be good. We'll be set for this game. Lamet too. So I was thinking Lamet, Lawrence, Johnson, if the game got close. It obviously didn't. Rockies won 7-2. But they did throw Lamet and Lawrence, both of whom worked really, really well. But those surprise moments, the two home runs that didn't seem super significant, but pushed the game from a save situation to a 5-run game. That's going to be something the Rockies are going to need to have a lot of to succeed this year. Why do I say this? The Rockies are simply not a very good team with runners on base, right? They got 7 runs. It's not bad. You can't complain about it. But 27 runners left on, this game could have very well been 11-2, 12-2. But it was only 7-2. So since it's 7-2, it means that the Rockies still have some work to do with regards to runners on base, getting those guys in when they're in scoring position. And that means they're going to need a few of these moments a game, moments where you're like, this is really not what I'd consider a big time, but they're going to need something big to happen. That's what the Crone home runs and the Montero home run, he only hit one last night. That's what those instances showed the Rockies are going to need a lot more of throughout this year if they're going to be competitive and reach the expectation of 500 that ownership has placed on them or even go further. So that was the first thing that I noted from opening day, those surprise moments. Another note that I made was more strategic. So I've been also touting prior to this podcast and during the first few episodes of this podcast, that the way to succeed at Coors Field is to have an arsenal that is 55% fastball, 23% slider, 17% changeup, with other variables mixed in. Very little curveball. In fact, no curveball, that might be just fine. So it was very encouraging to see last night the effective use of the fastball slider combo from all pitchers except for Jake Bird, who obviously doesn't really throw a slider. He throws a strange little cutter slider thing. It looks more like a cutter. So I think Baseball Savant has it listed as a cutter. Nonetheless, the fastball slider combo was beautiful. It was beautiful last night. I believe all 5 of Marquez's strikeouts came on beautifully, beautifully located sliders. I know Lamet threw 2 spectacular sliders for strikeouts in that 7th inning where it looked like the Padres might be mounting something, worked himself out of that jam with 2 beautifully placed sliders as well. And then Justin Lawrence just came in and slammed that 8th inning shut with 3 beautiful slider strikeouts. I'm talking beautiful. Like they might very well be the most beautiful sliders I've seen a Rockies pitcher throw in recent memory. Beautifully, beautiful spin, beautiful location. Everything was beautiful about that Lawrence inning. It was spectacular. It was beautiful. And then Jake Bird came in to lock the game down. The point is, every pitcher besides, save Jake Bird, who was kind of just put in to shut the game down at that point, it was 5-2 or 7-2. It was a 5-run game, really no stress. But all the pitchers who kind of came in relatively high leverage situations came in and they locked that game down with a fastball slider combo that was very, very effective. We'll get to my last takeaway from opening day and a preview of the upcoming week and some MLB news in a second. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Adjusting for Altitude. So I've already discussed my first few takeaways from the last week, most notably opening day with the umpiring things that I noticed around the league, in addition to the surprise moments that happened at seemingly not big times for the Rocks on opening day, in addition to the pitching staff working a beautiful fastball slider combination. I was also going to add an additional note to that. The fact that Herman Marquez was not really working much curveball. And in fact, the curveballs that he threw on opening night is what it effectively was. The curveballs that he threw, while few and far between, were really not good at all. I think he spiked every single curveball that he threw last night. So he was really forced to work fastball slider, which is what I've been saying he should work. I don't think I've said it on this podcast specifically, but I have been saying, obviously with my mold of a pitcher who would succeed at Coors Field, it just works well. So it was good to see Herman work fastball slider very effectively. But now I'm going to move on to my last takeaway that I had really from opening game, opening day, opening night, however you'd like to refer to it. Charlie Blackmon. So in my preseason projections episode, my comprehensive roster analysis where I gave my predictions for the Rockies roster, their lineup, etc., I had Charlie sliding in this lineup in the seventh spot. And that seemed fairly reasonable to me. I mean, he really hadn't played a ton this spring. He was coming off of injury. He's also getting older. So everything just seemed to come together to form this beautiful thing that would have been Charlie Blackmon batting in the seventh spot. Little did I know that Chuck obviously heard this podcast and obviously took my claims that he should be batting in the bottom third of the order very, very personally. He went 3-for-5, 3-for-5 in this game. He found himself on base in situations to be scored. He was actually, I believe, on base in two, if not all three, maybe all three, of the situations where we had runners on second and third and one out in the first five innings. Chuck did look really good on opening day, and I'm not going to lie. If he continues looking like this, he should not be batting seventh. He should be batting exactly where he was last night, which is the three hole. So props to Buddy for putting trust in Chuck that I don't think a lot of Rockies fans really had in him coming into this year. But why? Why did Chuck have some success? And in order to realize why Chuck seemingly might not only have had success last night, but might have success throughout the year with the bat, we have to look back to 2018. 2018 was really the last year we could really say Chuck was a legit offensive player. All things considered, I was watching a few months ago, actually, some highlights of the Brewers-Rockies 2018 NLDS series. I know. I just apparently wanted to be sad that day for whatever reason. But I was, and I noticed something about Chuck's stance. I noticed that Chuck's bat head tended to be a little bit more flat on his initial setup. And that allowed him to get his bat head through the zone a lot easier, a lot smoother, and it resulted in more hits, obviously. So it was very, very encouraging last night to see that Charlie Blackmon did indeed, apparently, I don't know if he noticed it or not, hopefully he did, because it looks like he did. He looks like he's back to the flattened bat. It looks like he's back to the successful stance that he had back in 2018, 2017, etc. Now, for those of you who aren't really sure what I'm talking about, for the last few years, Chuck has had a more upward pointing bat. If I had to describe it in terms of angle, I'd say it usually hung right around 50 to 60 degrees. All right, think of your protractor, the protractor that's probably buried somewhere under a bunch of books or papers in an office room somewhere, because once you finished geometry or whatever math class that required a protractor, once you finished that one, you just threw it away, didn't think about it anymore. Go find it. Go find 60 degrees. That's at about what Chuck's bat angle was last year. It's not that way this year, and it wasn't that way in 2018. And since 2018 was the last good year he had offensively, this is very, very encouraging for me. Obviously, he had the 3-for-5 game on opening day, and hopefully this continues. That's a trend I like to see. So that's a technical note that I was very pleased by. The other technical note that I'm not very pleased by is Ryan McMahon. I'm sorry. Sorry, Mac. I'm sorry. He K'd twice, went 1-for-5. You really honestly should not have gone 1-for-5. Could have very well gone 0-for-5 if whoever was pitching, I don't remember who was pitching at that point in the game, but if they had just thrown him one more high fastball, that would have been it. He would have been 0-for-5 with 3 Ks. Ryan's stance, man, I think I've finally figured out why Ryan McMahon is incapable of hitting fastballs seemingly at the belt or higher. his stance simply doesn't allow for it. And this is another thing. When I was trying to make my own comeback to baseball in high school, I was messing around with a lot of stances. And one stance that I messed around with was a semi-closed stance. So I wasn't parallel to the pitcher. I was more so pointed slightly backwards, almost. I don't know how to describe this in terms of angles or degrees, but I was pointed slightly backwards, not parallel towards the pitcher or home plate, however you like to think of it. Ryan's stance is very similar in that he's more closed off. He starts more closed off than a lot of successful hitters do. And as a result of this, it's very easy to throw him up. Why? His hands aren't going to be fast enough for him to be able to get his bat head through the zone on 95, 96 miles an hour. At that part of the zone consistently, if at all. Apparently it's at all, because I don't think I've ever seen Ryan McMahon get a hit. I know he has, obviously. He's a Major League Baseball player who probably has before, but I've never seen him recently get a hit on a pitch at the waist or higher. His stance simply doesn't allow for it, and it showed again last night. Like I said in the preview episode number 2, he's an easy strikeout if you throw him a fastball waist or higher. So I'd like to see Mac work on that. Maybe he'll notice that and open up a little bit. I think that'd be super beneficial for him. Those were my initial takeaways from the Rockies opening day game. However, I didn't really have any others. But to those who are wondering, should we be encouraged by this solid start to the season? To that, I'd say, yeah. Yeah, I think you should be. I think you should be encouraged. There's a lot to be encouraged by. And it's not similar to what we were encouraged by in previous years. It's not simply, oh, a win. It's a solid win against a team that's supposedly solid, a team that's supposed to compete for a World Series this year, and on the road, they've already tied. I think this actually might be the most hits they've had on the road in over a year now. So it's very, very encouraging for me. It should be encouraging to you. If you feel encouraged, do not be ashamed of it. People will laugh at you and say, ha ha ha, you've been encouraged over the last few years. Look at what the team has done. And you will simply say, yeah, but it's a new season and I have new reasons to be encouraged this season. Let's go take a look at the week ahead.
The week ahead.
All right. So obviously the Rockies play tonight as of me recording this Friday evening against the Padres yet again. 7:40 start time as was previously scheduled, not due to rain or anything. Tonight on the bump, we have Kyle Freeland versus Nick Martinez. Now this will be a very interesting matchup for a few reasons. Number one is probably that in previous times, I have said that Kyle Freeland and Nick Martinez are very, very similar in their effectiveness, and that maybe even Nick Martinez is a tad bit better. So tonight, we literally get a matchup of Nick Martinez and Kyle Freeland on the bump in this game. Same lineup that the Rockies will be running out as their game one win against the Pods. Let's see if they can follow up their performance with a similar, if not better, performance tonight against the Padres. On Saturday, we've got Padres at Rockies again. That'll be at 6:40 Mountain Time. Jose Urania against Michael Wacha. Now, this will be very interesting. Obviously, we know what Urania can bring to the table. He pitched well in California last year when the Rockies picked him up. I think his first start with the Rockies was against the Dodgers. He pitched very well in that game. So Urania apparently likes California. The Rockies, however, do not like Michael Wacha. I do not believe they performed very well against him when they faced him this spring. I think that was the game they got blown out in. I don't remember exactly. But it'll be interesting to see how the Rockies lineup reacts to Michael Wacha on Saturday. On Sunday, the Rocks take on the Padres in the finale of the series. That'll be 2:10 Mountain Time. Austin Gomber will be taking on Seth Lugo. That's a surprise name. I actually didn't know he was a Padre until this week when I was checking opening day rosters. Good for Seth. I think this is a game the Rockies can win. I think Gomber, I don't know his exact stats against California teams recently, but I do think he's on a roll. He ended the spring on a very solid note. So I think that's a game the Rockies could potentially compete in. Seth Lugo has not been known to be an amazing all-star who's unhittable, so maybe the Rocks can get after Seth a little bit on Sunday to end the series against the Padres. After that, the Rocks promptly head over to Chavez Ravine to take on the Dodgers on Monday evening at 8:10 p.m. Mountain Time. Ryan Feltner will be on the bump for the Rockies, and no pitcher has been listed yet for the Dodgers. It'll be interesting. This is Feltner's first start of the year, or it soon to be will be his first start of the year. Let's see how he does. He did not have the spring he wanted or anybody else wanted him to have. So it'll be interesting to see if he can, at long last, get that command under control. I think he had a fairly solid outing against the Dodgers in LA last year, but we'll see how that game goes. And then they wrap up the short two-game series that they have against the Dodgers on Tuesday, another 8:10 p.m. start time game. For this game, the Rockies will no doubt run out Germán Márquez. That seems to be the rotation that they have in order. And that, again, there's no pitcher listed for the Dodgers. But, you know, anytime you've got Germán on the mound, you have a chance. And especially if he continues to effectively use that fastball-slider combo, I think the Rocks could be in for a close game two in that series, to say the least. Following that, the Rocks have Wednesday off before returning home for their home opener, opening day at Coors Field, 2:10 p.m. Mountain Time against the Washington Nationals. Kyle Freeland will be starting this game for the Rockies. There's no starter listed for the Nationals as of yet, but it'll be interesting to see how the Rocks perform in their first game of the year at Coors Field, returning to altitude after playing in L.A. for effectively an entire week. And then Friday, the next episode upload day, the Rockies will be taking on the Nationals in game two of that series at 6:40 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. Jose Ureña is likely to start this game for the Rockies. And again, no starter has been listed for the Washington Nationals. But other than that, that will wrap up this week's episode of The Week Ahead. I shouldn't say episode. I should just say segment, because the episode isn't quite done yet. And I'm being a little bit presumptuous, because we have some MLB news to get into. Now, there's not a ton of MLB news to get into, but nonetheless, most of it is injury-related, and injuries can be critical to the success of teams. That just makes sense, right? I think we think that makes sense. Anywho, around the league.
Around the league.
Now, there were a lot of significant injuries, actually, in the first week of the season. You wouldn't really envision that to be the case, but I guess anything can happen at any time. The Cardinals had two fairly notable injuries on opening day. Wilson Contreras went down with a knee contusion. He took a 103-mile-per-hour sinker off of his right knee, off of his shin guard, which apparently got enough of his knee that it caused a knee contusion. Thanks, Jordan Hicks. Contreras, I believe, will be day-to-day. His MRI came back clean, so there's not long-term damage, but we'll see how that impacts the Cards there. Giovanni Gallegos is another Cardinal who was injured. I watched a little bit of this game. I did not see him pitch, but to be fair, it seems like both teams just ran right through both of their bullpens in that game. There were a lot of relievers used, so I very easily could have missed him. It says that he just had some back pain that popped up during Thursday's loss to Toronto. So again, he is officially listed as day to day. Justin Verlander, however, for the Mets, is not day to day. He will be out for at least a week, which is when he will be reevaluated as a result of a low grade Terry's major strain. It's an upper arm injury, obviously not good for a starting pitcher, especially a starting pitcher who's making more money this season than the entire Oakland Athletics roster combined. So it'll be interesting to see how Justin Verlander recovers over the next week or so, and it'll be interesting to see when he makes his Mets debut officially. Max Fried also got hurt on opening day for the Atlanta Braves. That was one that I think I heard about when it happened, because that was a game I tuned into for all of 2 seconds and then left because it was 4-0 Braves, I believe, in like the second inning. And I was like, this is not going to end well. It ended up being pretty close until the ninth, when it eventually was not close anymore. But Max Fried did depart in this game from his opening day start with a left hamstring strain. He'll probably go on the injured list, so he'll be out for a little bit. Now, at long last, we get to the injury that I've been hyping up, kind of unintentionally, the entire episode, Daniel Bard. Daniel Bard will be on the 15-day injured list with anxiety. Now, some of you are probably going to scoff at this and say, oh my gosh, anxiety. How can you be anxious if you're a dude making multiple millions of dollars a year to play Major League Baseball? And to some extent, I would agree with you. Unfortunately, we're talking about a guy whose career literally almost ended and did effectively end for multiple years because he had the yips, something he could not get over, which significantly impacted his ability to pitch, especially in late game scenarios. So for a guy who has struggled with anxiety and in-game anxiety in some significant capacity over the course of his career, anytime a guy feels like he's just not in a good place to pitch, it's better that he take the time off and get right mentally, go get the help, which is exactly what he's done, and just recover fully before he's put back out on a major league mound. And I think maybe this was fully on display in that WBC appearance that Bard pitched in, where he gave up two walks and a single, along with throwing a wild pitch and hitting a batter en route to being pulled without getting an out in that game that the U.S. team had against Venezuela. So it's all been building for a while for Bard. Hopefully he recovers very, very quickly. He's very, very beloved. He's a very beloved member of our team and a very, very important member of a bullpen that's supposed to be much improved this year. There are a variety of other minor injuries that we could go over, like Michael Brantley, Hunter Brown, Yordan Alvarez, but all of those are fairly insignificant based on what I'm seeing. Nothing super major there. Harrison Bader and Carlos Rodon are both out for the Yankees. Ryan Pepiot, Tony Gonsolin for the Dodgers, Joe Musgrove for the Padres. I think he's supposed to be back sometime in a few weeks because he's going to begin a rehab stint from his broken toe sometime within the next week or so. Rhys Hoskins is still recovering from his torn ACL. Seiya Suzuki's kind of taking it a little bit slow. He's done a little bit of on-field batting practice in the last few weeks for the Cubs. But again, yeah, most of these are fairly minor injuries. And then, of course, you've got the one non-minor injury on the list, which is Liam Hendricks, who's still battling non-Hodgkin lymphoma cancer. So he will not be placed on the 60-day IL, apparently, to start the season, as he's making good progress. So that's an interesting note of improvement for Liam. Hopefully he continues recovering quickly, and we wish him a speedy recovery indeed. Other than that, that will wrap up today's segment of news from the MLB, and it will also wrap up today's episode as well. Thank you for listening to this episode of Adjusting for Altitude with me, Christopher Nelson II. And until I see you on next week's episode, I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay cool, and go Colorado Rockies.
This has been Adjusting for Altitude with Christopher Nelson II. If you are indeed a fan of Colorado Rockies baseball or simply a fan of MLB content, follow this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform and share this podcast with your friends and family. Baseball in Colorado is a complicated situation, but it is certainly not unsolvable. Until our next episode, take care and go Rockies.